Ace Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone Podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And we would just like to welcome you here tonight. And I'm just going to be honest about this. I'm just going to be upfront with what happened. This is our second time recording this episode.
Because Sam hates me.
I don't hate you.
No,
and
you
this
just,
wasn't
you just
my
goofed.
Fault. This,
no,
this
no.
is just something that happened. We had recorded,
it was Batman.
I would say 90% of the episode.
Oh yeah, we're closing
we
in.
We were at about an hour and a half, and suddenly an individual who I will not name called me, which then rang through to my iPad, which then stopped the recording, which then corrupted the last hour and a half. So we're back. We're not filled with existential despair. Well, we are, but not because of that. We're filled with existential despair because of the subject of tonight's show, which I'll tell you in just a moment. But really quick, we just want to give a quick shout out to everybody. This last week was amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
It was unreal. We ended the month, even missing an episode last month, we ended the month at 1,800 downloads. We broke our daily record for best downloads in a day twice within 1 week. We got 8 new Patreon sponsors. We also released that special bonus episode. That's the only time we're going to do that.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Yeah, yeah. We released the, on the normal stream here, we released the bonus episode that's on Patreon. Again, we're never going to do that again. That's a one-time only thing. So take a listen to that if you want to. It's pretty good. The majority is me just sitting there talking about Egyptian history. And then,
yeah, he didn't invite me to the show.
Well, that's not fair. And then the end of it is our little 15-minute debrief at the end of the King Tutankhamun episode. So, guys, amazing week. Probably our best week yet.
We are absolutely. Not meaning to toot our horn, but it was a fun one.
We're so past that. Anyway, we are on track. We're going to, I almost would put money on us beating our best week ever.
Don't jinx us.
I'm not going
Come
to.
Come on, man.
I have faith in our listeners. That's pretty good. So
I got nothing there, man. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
And there was something else.
It's all on your souls or shoulders. It's not us, it's you.
It is you. You're the reason we're doing this again. For the second time recording this episode. We are literally doing it because we don't want to let you, our fans, down, and we are so grateful that you're here to motivate us and make us better. So there was one other piece I completely
Right,
spaced
and I mean
it,
to be but, honest, if you know, if I murder you, everyone knows it now.
And who cares? I'm ready to die.
Sam, that All sweet, right. sweet release, huh?
Today, Jason.
Sam.
We.
Are.
No, we're not doing that.
Okay.
You're loopy from the rage. We are going to be covering Whitley Strieber's Communion, which is a factual account of his paranormal experiences that took place in 1985 in March. The book itself was published in 1987, and it details his encounters with entities that he calls the Visitor.
Right, and to give everyone a bit of perspective and background knowledge, Whitley was a well-known author before this time as well. He had a couple books that were adapted for film as well.
Mm-hmm.
One was The Hunger, and the other one was Wolfen?
The Wolfen.
Both of which were somewhat supernatural. The Wolfen was about essentially a race of, or I guess a species, huh? They weren't humans. It wasn't like lycanthropy, but yeah, a completely different species.
Of wolf people.
Of wolf, yeah. I mean, it has wolf in the name.
Which, for more on wolf people, stay around till the end of the episode. We have a great announcement.
Sam, what do you got for us? Anyway, and then The Hunger was kind of the similar lines where it was vampires,
mm-hmm.
but they were also of a different species. They weren't of human origin.
Yes.
And they eventually created
hybrids.
Human mm-hmm. vampire hybrids.
So another one of his most popular books is War Day, published in 1984. This is a collaboration between himself and another author by the names of James Konietzka. It's a fictional novel presented as a non-fictional account of the authors surviving a nuclear attack and chronicling the events that follow. And
which, sounds super awesome.
Oh, and yeah, like, I totally want to read
it. You know, the part of me that's a doomsday prepper, like, way back in my mind, we're like, ooh, that'd be a great backpack. Or, ooh, I could really use that tool set for when, you know, the world goes to all heck.
I could fit so many cans of canned food in that tote bag.
Exactly. You know, I've been carrying around bottle caps for some reason.
Okay,
the past 3 years.
All right.
I'm kidding. But anyway,
Survivor.
Super interesting topic. Probably speaks to all of us that are just waiting for the zombie apocalypse a little bit.
Well,
not
zombies,
it's nuclear. But I mean, like, I feel like apocalypse in a nutshell, you know, like, there's certain things that you would
apocalypse,
do anyway.
Right.
Yeah, like, I mean,
no matter what kind.
If something's going to happen.
Whether it's a nuclear
apocalypse. If you got your bug out bag, you got your bug out bag.
If it's a zombie apocalypse, if it's a puppy dog apocalypse, you're
okay.
going to need the
no,
same.
The puppy
basic.
Dog apocalypse, I'm going to need much more than what I would need
Very
for any of the others.
Special sets of tools. Yeah. You know, Strieber, beyond the events he chronicles in Communion here, which we're going to dive into in a minute, he's a pretty average everyday guy. He's a very successful author.
I watched him in an interview. He seems like a pretty normal dude.
He's not your stereotypical, and we're not trying to throw shade or make fun or anything like that, but you do have some people who report abduction encounters.
Yeah, he's not,
and
like, you know,
a specific
aliens.
Bent. Right. He seems like a totally normal guy. Nowadays, he's still writing books. Last year, in 2016, he published another volume in his Alien Hunter series. This one was called Alien Hunter White House. It is a completely fictional account. He runs unknowncountry.com, which is basically a blog for paranormal news and discussion. And he hosts his own podcast called Dreamland, which Jason actually got to listen to a little bit.
Yeah, I listened to about 40 minutes of. I just found a clip on YouTube. Pretty interesting stuff, and actually some of it goes over some of the events that we'll also be talking about here tonight. Now, he was a fairly established author,
yes.
I think, that we pointed out, and then he came out with Communion, which kind of catapulted him into pretty much like a household name.
Yeah, stardom in its own way. It came out in 1987, and pretty much overnight he skyrocketed to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. It actually just turned 30 last month, Communion did. So it is still around.
Sorry.
It's still being discussed because it is an amazing book. And while we're going to go into some of the accounts in the book, like, I'm not going to do it justice. This whole first episode is going to be us just giving you the bare bones of what happened. The second episode will be more theories. And I recommend, even if you're able to sit all the way through this episode and next episode and listen to us talk, still,
I mean, you don't have to sit. You can walk.
You can jog.
You can stand.
Anything.
Ride a bike.
The world is your oyster, dear listener.
Unless you have to listen for things, then, I mean, traffic.
Right, yeah, please don't. Like, air traffic controllers,
I mean,
probably not.
Save this for home.
Yeah, yeah. But
listen safely. And responsibly.
Thank you, Dos Equis guy.
Did you just call me the most interesting man in the world? I'm going to take that.
All right.
Anyway, let's... How about
still,
we...
Well, still go buy the book. That's what I was going to say. Still go buy Communion. It's still amazing. We're only going to scratch the surface of it here. One last thing to note. Two more things to note. The first one is that even though he does write fiction books, he has always, for the last 30 years, stood by Communion as being a completely factual account. To back this up, he has actually taken a polygraph test. He has been analyzed by psychiatrists. He passed the polygraph test saying he wasn't lying.
Right. So
granted,
he absolutely believes that this was an experience that he had.
Yes. And then the psychiatrists all said, he's normal. He's good. No brain tumors, no temporal lobe epilepsy, no mental illness. So...
Okay.
Keep all of that in mind.
We've got a ton of information to cover.
Yes.
Why don't you dive us on in?
All right. So the events of Communion, we're going to take from this both from his journalistic approach, as well as he actually underwent hypnosis multiple times to try to make sense of this. We're just going to blend that all into one account here.
His book definitely jumps back and forth quite a bit between different time periods. We're going to try to keep it as linear and streamlined as possible.
Still not going to be super linear, but...
Try. I said
we're
try.
We're going to try. So the events of Communion begin on the night of December 26th, 1985. Now the Strieber family, that's Whitley, that's his wife Anne, and their son Andrew... had just enjoyed a peaceful, joyful Christmas the day previously, and they had a cabin in upstate New York. They had an apartment in the city and a cabin in the country.
Right, and I mean, for reference, this cabin's quite a ways out isolated. There as well. Yeah,
isolated.
Very
his,
isolated.
His nearest neighbor, I think, is about a mile, maybe half a mile, but he is not by any means surrounded by people or even close to people.
Right.
Now, he recalls eating Christmas leftovers. He recalls sledding with his son, who had just gotten his first sled as a gift. The day itself seemed pretty normal, nothing really unusual, until the middle of the night. He's laying in bed, and he describes hearing a peculiar whooshing and swirling noise coming from downstairs. Now, he said specifically this was no random creak, no settling of the house, but a sound as if a large number of people were moving rapidly around in the room. He immediately checked the burglar alarm, which was on the wall. It was still armed. It was active. It was not tripped. And the very first strange thing is actually his reaction. You would think that if you were in that situation, you'd probably, scared as you were, grab
go investigate, though.
Yeah,
yeah.
Grab a weapon, go investigate. He lays down.
I would be like, Anne, go see what it is, Anne.
I can't do this right now.
You know Kung Fu. Come on, Anne.
Just lays down and tries to go back to sleep. And he accepts and admits that that is not a normal reaction, but that sort of thing happens during the course of the book, where you think he should behave in one way, and he just does the exact opposite, not through any free will of his own. But so he's laying in bed. He states that he's fully conscious. He says, "I was not asleep, nor in a hypnopompic state between sleep and waking. I wish to be clear that I felt at that moment wide awake and in full possession of my faculties. I could have easily gotten up and read a book or listened to the radio or gone for a midnight walk in the snow." Now, the other thing.
Right, so I just real quickly to point out, a lot of people, including myself, that believe that at least some of abductions, when a person wakes up in the middle of the night and feels paralyzed and they see something at the foot of the bed, or feel pressure on their chest, that's known quite commonly as night terrors. It has
sleep
a whole
paralysis.
Bunch of sleep paralysis,
the old hag syndrome,
the witch sitting, things like that. What he's describing is simply the fact that he knows that that is not what he was experiencing.
Exactly. So it should also be stated that since October, just a few months earlier, he had, and he's not really sure why, he had become very paranoid at night.
Oh, yeah.
He had been searching the house and checking closets and checking doors.
Making sure the doors are locked and everything multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was this way about, like, my homework in middle school where I'd check it right after
I do it?
Oh, yeah.
Did I do it?
Like, exactly, man. I'd check it right after I finish it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd check it, like, after dinner. And then I'd check it before I went to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd check it when I got up in the morning. And then I checked it when I got to school. I had issues.
I bet.
And I kind of understand where he's coming from that.
I do this every night. I mean, we record in my spare room. I live in a house that's like, I want to say maybe 700 square feet. It's very small.
It's a little two-bedroom.
Yeah, it's got two bedrooms,
One bath.
A bath, and every night I go through every inch of it and just check. So I don't know if that says anything about me or the visitors, but...
Well, Sam, maybe you should cut back on the research.
That's true. I really need to. This book ruined my life. Anyway, so he had done that this night, just like every night, and he had come up clean. No problems there, no big issues. However, for whatever reason, he suddenly had a memory of an earlier event that actually took place in July. He had been sitting in his den in the cabin. He had heard footsteps coming from behind the house towards the road, going towards the road, which is pretty opposite of what you would think if it was just somebody wandering around at night or a burglar. You'd think they come from the road and then get on the property. But he hears these footsteps that night in July, and he says, okay, I'm sure I'm just imagining things, but there's a motion-sensitive light, and if the light goes on, I'll grab my gun, I'll go down there. Literally, as soon as he had told that to himself, the light went on, he grabbed his gun, he got outside, he clocked himself at like 10 seconds, and there was nothing there. And the light never actually worked after that.
And one of the ways he was able to clock himself as well is the fact that it was a 15-second essentially light, right? It only shone for about 15 seconds.
But the thing about it is the light never turned off after that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So he had to replace the entire fixture, too. Eventually, it just wouldn't shut off again.
Yeah, so...
Something went a little haywire.
A little weird there. He did. He replaced the whole thing a little weird in that July. That was what he was thinking about laying in bed on that night of December 26th. Now, what he sees next, again, in this totally aware state, he sees the door begin to close. And the door closes out. So right. It's as if there's something in the hallway that has grabbed the door and is pulling it away from him, concealing whatever might be behind it. He is just out of his mind with fear. He's laying there. Suddenly, the door swings back open, and he sees a figure standing there. He said it was pretty short. He clocked it at about 3 feet. It wore a smooth, rounded hat, some sort of metallic plate covering the chest, and he described the eyes of the creature as just dark holes. No iris, no pupil, no life whatsoever.
And essentially like a little slit for a mouth, right?
Yeah, a slit for a mouth that was frowning.
Slightly pointed down.
Yeah.
Slight frown.
Yeah. Now the figure rushed him, and this is his first blackout. His entire memories of the night, even in hypnosis, are very disjointed, are very non-linear. And so the very...
Fragmented, yeah.
Yeah. So the figure rushes him, and he blacks out. The next thing he knows, could be seconds, could be hours later, he's still in the room, but he's stripped naked, and he's being carried. His body is frozen in like a mid-leap, as if he had tried to jump out of the bed to meet the thing, but he just froze there.
He gets stuck in a stasis.
Yeah. He gets carried out of the room. Next thing he knows, he blacks out. He wakes up again. He's in a depression in the woods, which he thought it was odd because it was upstate New York and it was winter.
Right. He'd be freezing.
He'd be freezing, and they had just gone sledding on the mountains of snow days before, and yet there was no snow in the circular depression. There was no snow. There was no evidence of snow moisture at all. And this is when he starts to regain some feeling. He can feel the cold. He can feel like the moss and the sticks and stuff. And he looks across from him, and it may be the same entity. It may be one that just looks exactly like it. But there is sitting across from him this 3-foot-tall being that just had black holes as eyes. And this time, instead of his mouth being a slit and kind of downturned, the mouth was just a black hole as well. He noted that to the right of him, there was another different type of being that seemed to be working on something frantically. It seemed to be wearing like blue coveralls, like what a painter would wear. To the left of him, though, there was a stereotypical gray. It had...
And you mean by that?
Oh, yes, I forget.
Yeah.
I'm talking to normal people as well.
So a gray is...
A gray is your stereotypical alien. It's the little dude with the big head, oblong head, deep...
Slender.
Yeah, slender, huge, slanted eyes. Yeah, that's what was to the left of him. For whatever reason, he thought of this being as feminine, even though it spoke in an extremely deep voice, and it was talking to him, and
was it like actually talking or like telepathy?
That he states multiple times that it was talking, but then at other times he does state that its mouth wasn't moving. So it may have been a combination.
Okay.
The only thing explicitly stated in the book is the telepathy. So it may just all be telepathy.
Okay.
But he does note that it doesn't really have lips. It doesn't really have, he said its mouth was vestigial, which I looked it up. That means that there was something there and it's gone now. So
that's spooky.
Yeah, it's super spooky. But if it's a telepathic species, it doesn't need a mouth, you know?
Right. Well, just to eat.
Right. That's true. Well, I'm sure they can figure something out.
Yeah, dude. IVs.
IVs. The figure to his left, the feminine figure, is talking to him, doesn't really remember what he's saying. She sounds bored, and like she's done this 100 times. Suddenly, he describes himself as being lifted up. He goes through the branches of the trees. He looks down, he sees the trees underneath him.
Beam me up, Scotty.
Right, exactly. And then suddenly, once he's above the trees, he notices a floor close.
Yep.
It freaks him out. He states in the book that he dies. he as in Whitley dies. And all that's left is
essentially he's just running, yeah, on animal instinct.
Mm-hmm. He finds himself in this dark, cramped little room, and he stays there for a few minutes just looking around until finally some beings, some figures rush into the room. They grab him and they take him to another room and sit him down on a bench. Now this female being appears again. She tells him, there is going to be an operation. We are going to operate on you. And as he's being told this, he is shown this needle that is so thin that when it moves, it glints in the light, but really apart from that,
you can't see it. No, yeah. It's just the reflection of the light. That's the only indication that's really physically there.
Yeah.
What if it's like a nano or like a...
Like nanobots?
Not like nanobots, but I mean like in sci-fi, there's also like these nanoblades or whatever that come down to like be an atom thin.
Mm.
They're crazy. If it's like an actual needle, it has to, of course, have like a tube shape, so it can't be that small, right. But very small in that kind of an instance.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never heard of that concept before.
Yeah. Sci-fi. Never mind. Keep going.
I can dig it, man.
Cool stuff, right?
Dig it. But she does. She says there's going to be
an... I would cut myself on that so quick.
Oh my gosh, I wouldn't have any fingers.
It'd just be like, whoop. Oh. Well, now.
There they go.
The cleanest cut.
We need that to dispose of our enemies.
No, we don't.
All right. Sam. Anyway.
We can't even afford ceramic knives, okay?
I can't afford no one atom knife. I use a rock.
Like a real man. Like a caveman. Real
man. He's shown this needle.
Yep.
Told there's going to be an operation. He immediately starts screaming.
Freaking out.
Just like you or I would say. So the next thing that happens is a little weird. She says... Is there anything we can do to make you stop screaming?
Yeah, because he's freaking out.
He's freaking out.
He's panicking.
And he says, you could let me smell you. Which, at the very first time you hear that, sounds really strange.
Right. Of course.
Of course, I mean, smell has been...
linked to a ton of stuff.
Yeah, it's been linked to...
Of course, taste, but also memories.
And also, like,
it actually does, yeah. Exactly. It's a known technique to kind of... send her someone.
Yeah, but it works. She holds her hand under his nose. He smells it, and it's a smell that he describes as smoldering cardboard mixed with organic sourness. And then the last one, it has an undertone of cinnamon.
Smoldering cardboard's a weird... I'm gonna have to go light some cardboard on fire.
Yeah, just do it.
Like, that's such...
There's a cardboard box up there.
A very specific kind of smell.
Yeah. And it all combines to make this one extremely identifiable smell. Going forward, this grounds him, just like he had hoped it would, she would hoped it would. He stops screaming, and he, in a little bit more composed of a fashion now, he starts to argue, and he says, you have no right to perform an operation on me. And she says, we do have a right.
What?
Right? So
yeah, that's what she said. I understood what she said, but I don't get it.
Whitley has his own theories about what she meant by this. The fact that they're an advanced species and to them we are a lower species.
Yeah, we're just something to play with.
Yeah, the same way that we exercise our mastery over the ants here on Earth, they exercise their mastery over us. I have a different idea. I'm not even going to go into it.
Aww.
Because it's going to be pretty much the subject of next week's bonus episode for all of our Patreon listeners. Yeah. So,
you just dangle that right now in front of us, don't you?
Stay tuned for that. She says, we do have a right. And he doesn't remember what happens after that. He doesn't remember any sort of argument, anything else. All he remembers is a boom and a flash. He feels a jolt and he sees a flash of light and he realizes it's over. They did it. The needle is in my brain already. Now, after this, he appears, he's dragged into a type of operating room. In the room, he categorizes the four different types of aliens. We already talked about three. The first is the robot kind, which has the black holes for eyes, the black hole for a mouth.
Yeah, the super creepy one.
Yep, the super creepy one. The second one, he kind of mentions they're wearing blue...
The tinkerers.
Yeah, they're wearing blue coveralls.
I like to think of it as little mechanics
on
the ship.
Yeah, that's literally exactly what I always think of them.
Yeah, that's exactly how I picture them. Yeah. Little mechanics.
Now, they're short, they're stocky, they have wide faces, they're dark gray or dark blue, and they have, like, pug noses
mm-hmm.
and vaguely human mouths. The third, is your stereotypical gray. The only thing that's a little different from that is that their skin is more of a brownish. It is a difference from your normal description, but I'm still just going to refer to her as the gray, because that is what it seems that okay. she falls into, coloring aside. And the fourth is just like the third, slender, slightly elongated skull. The third, though, is about 5 foot high. The other ones, the robot's like, I want to say like 2 foot. The mechanic's like 3 foot. I believe the fourth is like 3 to 4 feet.
So little.
They're
little.
It's just a little version of it. But their eyes, unlike being the slanted, deep black eyes.
They're button eyes.
They're black buttons. Yeah. Now, he doesn't know if anything happened in the operating theater, even under hypnosis. He doesn't really go further into it. What happens next, though, and if you are listening with kids, I'd recommend that you maybe skip ahead
a little bit. Minutes. Yeah, just a little.
What happens next is that he's taken to another room. His legs are spread apart, and he's shown a triangular rod with a little point, which on the point there's like a nib that's made of mesh and wire. This is inserted into his rectum. He's probed, and he says that he thinks that they might be searching for like fecal samples and stuff like that. That's pretty much the last thing he remembers on the ship. There's one other thing, which is that he just remembers looking at his finger and seeing an incision being made. But there's no blood. He doesn't even see anything inserted.
So weird.
Or anything.
Like, an incision on the finger. I keep trying to think of what kind of significance that could come from. And, of course, the first thing that comes to my mind is, you know, diabetes. Pricking your finger just for blood sampling.
Oh, that's true.
But there's
blood.
Yeah, but there's totally other ways you can go about doing that. Like, a prick on the finger or a cut incision on the finger doesn't quite do that. I mean, there's just no really significance of doing anything to our fingers. Brain makes sense.
Yeah.
Rectum makes more sense.
Yeah.
Our appendages, our arms, our fingers, I miss it. I'm not finding that
point. It doesn't make sense. And you know, that's what's
so.
Unless
a tracker.
That's what's so. Well, it could be an implant.
Mm-hmm.
Although you would think that that might be what the needle was. But that's what's so.
See, I would have assumed the needle would have gone for like the part of your brain that maybe produces like hormones. Is that, does your pituitary gland still does that just all the time? Okay.
Pretty sure.
I'm almost positive because I feel like that'd make a lot of sense of something that you'd poke a needle into in order to
so
get
stuff
out of.
So maybe they were just getting things out. They weren't inserting it for good. Because I've always just assumed that the needle is still in his head.
Oh!
Yeah.
Well, that sucks. That would suck. Yeah. Maybe?
Yeah. Weird. There is.
See, yeah, the way that you describe it, I assumed that the needle was long enough to where it was essentially like a craniotomy or something, like
that's
where
fair.
It's still sticking partially the way out and they're doing stuff. And it being a needle would.
Right, which we don't know if it is. That could have just been his.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's his description.
Strange. Interesting.
Yep. More to ponder about.
Yeah, well, and he doesn't touch on it. He just tells what happens. And
right.
that is. He doesn't spend his time trying to say, like, why did they put a needle in me? Why did they cut my finger? He spends his time grappling with, like, deep philosophical questions, and he just leaves the rest of it up to whatever, which is such a difference. I actually read an article about how a communion was so different because it wasn't trying to explain everything. He was just trying to say what happened to him. And,
okay.
And that's part of the reason why it survived, because if he was to take all of this and then say they're making a hybrid breeding program and we're all going to be enslaved and all
right,
that,
if he's
he would
jumping
have been
to conclusions, then no, okay.
He'd be written off, just like so many UFO researchers are.
There's
but
the crazy ones.
He sees the incision on his finger. The next and last thing he remembers is being on his couch. He's on his couch in a way that supposes he had always been on his couch, because he remembers thinking, I wonder if I should stoke the fire or not because it's dying. He chooses not to stoke the fire, lets it die, go to bed. So, the next day, he wakes up. He doesn't remember anything at first, except he just saw.
So this is the 27th.
This is the 27th. You've got it. He just remembers seeing this big owl just standing outside his window. He mentions it to Anne, who says, well, that's weird because I don't remember that at all. And B, there's no tracks, there's no feathers, there was no owl on the roof. Around this time also, he starts hearing talk from his neighbors. They're far away, but he does have neighbors talking about UFOs being sighted in the area, both that the night of the 26th, as well as earlier back in October and some other times. And he starts to lose it a little bit. He gets in contact with a UFO researcher named Bud Hopkins, and he says, "Bud, this is what happened. Like, have
this
you,
was my experience. Yeah, yeah. Is this normal?
Is this normal?
Has this happened before?"
And he said, probably the most comfortingly uncomfortable thing you could ever hear, which is, "Oh yeah, all the time. Oh yeah, man, totally." And that freaks him out. Whitley does not want to believe that this has anything to do with extraterrestrials. He thinks it's a psychological thing. He thinks it's a medical thing. He starts trying to research. He even calls Goodyear to see if the blimp was in the area, and that's what people saw, and it wasn't a UFO, and they're like, no blimp. He finally decides that it's not just a dream, it's not just a nightmare. To help him get on the path to understanding that, his fingers become infected.
That doesn't help him get on the path, but...
Well, that helps him realize that something happened, and he has unbearable rectal pain to the point where he had had trouble sitting down for a long time. He also just, according to Anne, his mood just worsened. He just got mean and short and tired, and all of this correlates to him deciding, okay, I need to go see a psychiatrist. I need to know if I'm crazy or not. He talks to Bud. Bud tells him of a great guy who works with a lot of abduction victims, and he says, great, I'm not going to that guy. I'm going to go to this guy over here, because he doesn't want, from the start, he doesn't want any influence of UFOs.
Second take, you're still pointing in directions no one will see but me.
Not here, but here.
The opposite direction, guys.
Yes.
That's for Sam's point.
The other place. And they do. They go to a fella. His name's Dr. Donald Klein. And Klein is a big believer in hypnosis. He thinks that these memories are all just suppression and different psychological things. And if they can break through it, they can find the truth of the matter, which is that, simply put, he's a disturbed individual who needs help. He definitely wasn't abducted by a UFO. He definitely didn't know
aliens more grounded
or anything
than...
like that. They do. They undergo the hypnosis. A lot of the parts of the hypnosis regarding to December 26th, we already mixed in that earlier recounting. So we're not going to talk about that. What we are going to talk about is in October. So like we had mentioned, he had been checking his doors and triple, double, quadruple checking every lock and closet and everything since the middle of October. On October 4th, they had had friends over to the cabin, and there was a confusing night. Basically, Whitley was up all night screaming and yelling about the roof being on fire. He was running all over the place, being just out of his brain. And finally, it all ended with a literal bang. There was some kind of loud, like a super firecracker that just calmed. Yeah, just centered everybody. Everybody finally looked around.
Everything kind of went back to normal.
Went back to normal. The roof's not on fire. No one's getting hurt, anything like that. And it's that bang that brought them all back. So what they discover under this first hypnosis is that night on October 4th, Whitley had actually seen an alien figure in his room. The figure had moved towards the bed. It was also a gray, and it touched his forehead with what can be described as a magic wand. He basically...
So, yeah, the way you describe it is a ruler with a
silver tip on it.
Silver tip on it. It's like a magic wand or a thermometer.
Right. One
Mercury.
Or the other.
It's one of those two. Anyway, continue on.
Well, and when this wand hits his forehead, he starts vividly seeing images. Now, the first one he sees is the world from space, and the planet Earth is blowing up. He sees the world enveloped in smoke and fire, pieces of it breaking off, and he hears a voice telling him, "This is your home. This is your home. you know why this will happen.
Does he recall if it was the feminine?
He doesn't.
Gray's
no.
voice? Okay, just a voice.
A voice, yeah. And Strieber gets upset. He starts screaming at the figure, who the vision has stopped. He sees the figure again. The figure again touches him on the forehead with the wand, and suddenly he sees his son playing in a park, in a garden-like park, and he gets so upset that he breaks out of hypnosis. And Dr. Klein says, what's going on? Like, why are you
freaking out like that?
Why are you freaking out? And he said, my son is dead. That's a vision of my son after his death. Like, this figure is threatening me. It's intimidating mm-hmm. me. Now,
to note as well, he is a practicing Catholic as well. So
yeah, so he has a heaven and a hell.
The garden mm-hmm. is being the afterlife.
Yes.
Just throwing that.
At this point as well, during the hypnosis, Bud Hopkins, who is there, he's there every step of the way, butts in and he says, like, that's a very common image. Both the world being destroyed and this garden, people see it all the time. They report seeing it all the time. So
it seems like it's a routine procedure.
Right, yeah. Just normal. Like,
terrifying. It's like they're gauging responses.
Mm-hmm. So they put him back under hypnosis. He goes back to that exact moment where right before the figure touches his head and he sees his son in the garden. That happens again. He sees it again, but this time he's further away from his son, and he talks about how his son looks wrong, how his arms are wrong. That's all he says. He doesn't say too long. He doesn't say if they're broken or anything like that.
Or malformed, nothing.
Malformed. He just says his arms are all wrong and his eyes are jet black. And in this hypnotic state, he tries to run to him and get to him, but the visitor takes the wand away again. The memory ends. He tries to fight this thing, but again, one last time, it hits his forehead, and he's shown an image of his father. Now, his father had died a number of years earlier, and he was always told by his mother that his father went peacefully in the night, that, you know, she sent him off to the afterlife with a kiss on the forehead, and it was calm and peaceful and sweet.
Kind of everything that you want when you die.
Yeah, totally. What he sees, though, is his father just laying there, choking and gasping and fighting, and his mother just not moving, just standing there watching him, and it freaks him out. And he mm-hmm. breaks out of hypnosis one more time, and they talk about that, and he has a very deep connection with his father. You can tell from this, you can tell from another account we're going to get into in a moment. He can't handle that. And they say, well, who knows if it's real? You know, it could be all sorts of things, but we need to keep going. Just one more, you know, just really quick. And so they do. They put him back under. All he sees from here, that memory of his, or memory, quote unquote, of his father dying in pain is gone. He simply sees the face of the creature, the being, the visitor,
mm-hmm.
holding up what appears to be a matchstick, which he strikes on thin air, and it creates a bright flash and that same bang, that same mega firecracker bang. And that's the end of the hypnosis. He has a few days between his hypnosis sessions, and he does, well, two events occur during them. The first is that he collaborates everybody's stories that was there on October 4th. All of them, and his wife, Annie, and Jox, his friends, they all describe the same bang. But they all have different accounts of, like, the night and the morning mm-hmm. after.
Now, real quick, just to kind of cut Sam off for a second, mm-hmm. If you guys are curious about those events as well, I have listened to his podcast, Dreamland, where he does interview Annie a little bit more. And this isn't the only weird thing that she recalls mm-hmm. from October. So, absolutely recommend diving in, checking that out.
Well, if I can find that same video, or if you can go to your history and find
it. I can find it.
I'll put it in the show notes. Now, not everybody, Anne and Jox, they just say it was a weird night and there was a bang. Annie says that it was a weird night, there was a bang, and then the following morning, this would be the morning of October 5th, She remembers Whitley coming downstairs and her saying something to the effect of, well, that was a heck of a night. And he says, yes, extraterrestrials came and visited the house.
And what?
She's like, what? And he...
You're going to talk about this over Morning Joe? What are you talking about here?
As he hears this over the phone, you know, 6 months later or whatever, he just is floored. And he says, no. I would not have said that.
Half asleep or something?
And she says, no, that's exactly what you said. It off-puts him, understandably, because at least the bang is real. At least that happens. So,
yeah, that's been confirmed with... everyone else at the house, at least three other people at the cabin.
The other thing that happens is that his mother calls him out of nowhere. And they talk for like 5 minutes about nothing. And then she says, I remember when your father died. And just talks about how peaceful and how beautiful it was and how much happened.
And it was also kind of impromptu. It's not like he provoked that conversation.
Absolutely nothing. And he does such a good job. All book, at least with everything he recalls and accounts for, he is never leading anybody ever. Never mentions UFOs, never mention, with one exception that we'll get into, never even brings it up because he does not want to taint anybody's ideas, because in that mind, he is tainting the evidence of his sanity, basically. You know, if the UFO is real, it's a bittersweet thing because it means he's not insane, but there are aliens.
Right, yeah.
Now, if it's not real, he is insane.
Might be a little loopy.
But they're not aliens.
But
And I don't know which one I'd prefer there.
I mean, I'm sure he was probably struggling with that same predicament.
Mm-hmm. Now, he goes back. They talk about it a little bit more in another hypnosis session. And they decide, okay, we're going to go back over the 26th, back over the 4th. They cover all the information we've already talked about except for one last thing, which is they say at a certain point on the 26th, Whitley says, why are you doing this to me? And they say, because you are our chosen one. And he just immediately snaps and says, bullcrap. I don't believe that. And it seems like it's a joke to them. Mm-hmm. Like they're laughing among themselves.
You're the chosen one.
Yeah. This guy thinks he's the chosen one. And Dr. Klein says, well, why did you say that? Why did you call BS on it? And he says it's because of all these other people. And he describes seeing a row of people. Now, what they find through a little bit more picking and prodding is that when he was 12 years old, he, his father, and his sister were on a train. They seem to have been, based upon this, abducted from the train. And 12-year-old Whitley is sitting there, and he remembers seeing a row of human bodies. He doesn't know if they're alive or not.
Okay.
The same female gray is standing by him as he is 12 years old, as he was in 1985. She's just talking to him about these people he picked up and all of that. His father comes around the corner, sees her, and gets super freaked out. That breaks the hypnosis again. Again, he has such a strong connection with his father that seeing him afraid makes him too afraid to continue with the hypnosis. And in that moment, he realizes that this is not something that's been happening since October. This has been happening since he was at least 12 years old. The only recollection that Whitley has of this trip, and in the book, he talks about his feelings for like 30 minutes, so, or for like 30 pages, so we're just going to jump over that. But he begins to realize that he has these different memories of things that never happened, one of which is the owl on the rooftop. The other one is on that train home, he remembers seeing the train from above, as if he had been flying above it. He also remembers seeing a wolf on the side of the train tracks who howled, and he remembers hearing the howl. Of course, it's a beautiful image. It doesn't make any sense if you're on a train going however fast it is.
Like, let's just say 60.
60 miles an hour.
Sounds about fair.
You might see the wolf for a second. You're definitely not going to hear it howl. But this image was so central to him that, like, he loves wolves because of that memory. He wrote the wolf in partly because of that memory. But then he realized that it just wasn't true. And this brings up the idea of a screen memory, which is something that's talked about by Sigmund Freud, according to Freud, it's something that naturally happens. When something occurs that we cannot understand, we shield it. So, for instance, the owl.
Yeah, our minds subconsciously try to protect us from it.
Exactly.
Or make sense of it.
Mm-hmm. What he saw was one of the visitors. But because the visitors to his mind do not exist, he saw an owl staring at him. He saw a wolf simply because it gave him something else to be doing and somewhere else to be other than on a UFO at that point. He also has a memory of when he was just two, he would think, he was like at his grandmother's and he saw this herd of gray monkeys coming up over the mountainside. And it's these sort of things where it's just wrong. Like, it's just wrong, but it's wrong to the point where you don't think it's wrong until you think about it. Mm-hmm. The same thing. He had always described and always pictured seeing the train from above.
Yeah.
But he never really thought, oh, that doesn't make any sense until 1986. Same thing with the wolf. Same thing with the owl, although the owl he caught on to. The other... So that's screen memories.
Yep.
The other thing that kind of plays...
The more you know.
Yep.
There we go.
The other thing that kind of plays a part in this is... missing time. He's got dozens of accounts of missing time, but I'm just going to go over one of them because it's super, super, super compelling. And missing time is exactly what it sounds like. It's 12 o'clock, now it's 2 o'clock. Where did the time go? So the one story we're going to touch on here, again, he has dozens of screen memories and missing time stories, but he talks about when he's 20 years old, he moved into an apartment in August, and pretty much right as soon as he got there, he had a lazy day. He was heating up a TV dinner for lunch. It was noon when he sat on the couch with the food in his lap. He went to take a bite and realized that the food had jumped from his lap to the table. He felt it and it had gone cold. And he looked and suddenly it was 2 p.m. So he's a little confused, but he does. He thinks, oh, I must have just fallen asleep. So he gets up. He goes and sets the timer. He puts the food back in the oven, sets the timer for 15 minutes, and suddenly he feels super woozy, and his mouth is dry, and he is just ravenously hungry, and he looks outside, and the light is fading, and it's 6 p.m., and he says, what the hell? He opens the oven, feels the food, it's still cold, and he is just straight up terrified, and he says, I'm suffering from blackouts, like there's something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
So he turns and reaches for the phone. When his hand hits the phone, he realizes it is pitch black outside, and it is 12 o'clock midnight. And it's not...
That's crazy. He's experienced it within like 10 seconds.
And that's the thing that makes it like different from, well, his memories on the ship are very disjointed. This is a continuous stream
of
memories.
This is him... Also, it's like going through the motions, but like he's going at an extreme slow motion.
Exactly. And so his hand hits the phone and it's midnight and he says, I gotta get out of here. I gotta get out of here. But he hasn't eaten or drinking anything for at least 10 hours. He says, okay, I'm going to get something to drink and we're going to go. He moves to the sink. The next thing he knows, there's a cup in the sink. There's the water tap on. The water is overflowing over the cup and it is 4:15 in the morning. And he
just constant jumps.
Yeah. And he finally breaks out of it. He just runs out of the house, gets in his car and drives to this all night diner. He says he had breakfast of like eggs and bacon and pancakes and hash browns and 5 glasses of orange juice. And he doesn't have any more missing time. But what he does recall is something of inexplicable beauty happening, seeing something of inexplicable beauty while on the road to the diner.
Oh, I was going to say, well, that breakfast sounds pretty great.
even right now, when the last time I ate was like 4 hours ago, it sounds amazing.
Mm.
But he always told his friends it was the Perseid meteor shower, which hadn't occurred on that night. He didn't know what it was, so his brain just said, oh, it was the meteor shower. But...
Interesting.
You can read it between the lines there. So... A few weeks later, he's visiting his grandmother in Austin, and suddenly he's transported back in time to this night, and he is getting in his car and pulling away, and suddenly a demon, what he describes as a demon, mm-hmm. presses his face to the glass and starts screaming at him. And he just pulls off and drives away. So that's
terrifying. When was that again? How old was he?
He was 20. Now, one other kind of just part of Whitley's life that's really worth talking about, because it shows the totality of the visitor phenomena in his life, is something I like to call Whitley's Great Escape.
Nice.
So within weeks of having that frightening dream, which he actually later decides is a memory that's being uncovered of the demon pressing its face to the glass, he finds himself desperately wanting to leave the University of Texas as well as just the United States in general. However, he didn't say, oh, that was scary and now I want to leave. So first he travels to London and enrolls in the London Film School or School of Film Technique. After a few months, however, he had some sort of experience he can't fully recall. He just remembers jumping across rooftops to get away from something and seeing down people's chimneys and just waking up at home.
Weird.
Super weird. And then that makes him say, well, again, not really connecting that event with his sudden desire to move. He books a 2-week trip to Italy. He makes it to the continent, boards a train. He states, my memories when observed individually make sense, but when put together, do not. So he recalls seeing and meeting on the train to Rome this young woman. Again, doesn't remember anything about her other than she is a feminine presence. And then from there, they're on their way to Rome. The train stops in Florence. They get off the train and they stay in Florence. For some people, after he got back, he would say, oh yeah, I lived in Florence for 6 weeks one time. Other times he says it's just a few days. But in any case, when War Day comes out, they decide to publish it in Italian. He actually goes to Florence and he realizes he has never been in that city in his entire life. And so he just has all of these memories of places that don't even exist. Finally, whether it's after a few days or 6 weeks, they get back on the train, they go to Rome, and in Rome, for some reason, he doesn't remember why, but they split up and he suddenly is on the run. He travels all throughout Europe, just hopping onto trains at the last minute. He finally ends up broke in Spain, and he just spends his whole time holed up in this dingy hotel. He wouldn't open the windows, he wouldn't turn on the lights, he wouldn't go outside, and he has no idea why he was so afraid or what he was running from. He doesn't even remember how, but one day he just ends up back in London. He's in front of a hotel, it's like midnight. He books himself in, goes in the morning to where he was living, and the management said, your room is gone and your stuff's in storage. And he says, what the heck? Why? He's like, because you told us you were going to be gone for 2 weeks. You've been gone for months. Like, we're not just going to keep your room open for
freaky.
You. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, interesting. And even then, though, it's one of these paradoxical things. He should be sitting down at that point and saying, where was I? What was going on? He just accepts it. He just says, oh, you're right. I was gone for weeks. In fact, he talks about when he realized that he hadn't gone to Florence, mm-hmm. He said, oh, that's right. I didn't go to Florence. I went to Russia.
What?
Yeah. His brain.
Florence and Russia, they're very easily mistaken.
Right. His mind will not allow him to look closely at these events. And it just creates screen memories. And then when they get broken, it creates more and more and more, to the point where he still doesn't know what happened to him during those months he was missing. Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That sounds like an awesome movie right there.
Right?
Just that.
Right? But.
And then he wakes up in the Matrix.
God. But he then moves from there, moves in with a friend, finishes out film school, jump ahead to 1970. He and his now wife, Anne, move to an apartment in New York. They live there for 7 years. However, in April of 1977, another bizarre occurrence takes place. They're sitting there listening to a record. The record ends, and suddenly someone starts talking to them through the stereo. And they're a little put off, but they respond, and then it responds back. And their stereo doesn't have a microphone.
Right. It's a stereo. Yeah. It's One Direction.
Exactly. It doesn't even have a tape deck. So it would have had to been some signal coming through. And again, it's just you looking at it, you're like, come on, man. But again, he says, well, now I want to move. And he doesn't think of anything about the stereo or anything. He says, well, I want to move. So they move. By May, they're in a new home. A little more than a year later, they begin to receive phone calls in the night. Just menacing, threatening. He remembers looking out the window in the dead of night and seeing some figure just standing in the garden, looking up at him.
What?
Yeah. And he says, not for any reason connected to that, but I would like to move again, Anne. And Anne says, you know what? I agree. I completely agree. They don't talk about it at all. They just pack up and move. Next up, they move to Connecticut, which is where they had Andrew. One night, he just awakes to the feeling of people pouring into the house through the windows. He gets up to get Andrew, but his memories of that night just end there. A few days later, they're sleeping, I assume with the window open, and they just hear screaming, the both of them, not from within their house, but from outside their house. And they were talking to somebody a few days later, and they were like, how did you know, anything big happen, anything? And he said, oh yeah, the other night I was woken up by this screaming. And this guy lived a mile away from them. But it was the same night and the same type of screaming from what they could tell. And again, they say, well, not for any reason connected to the blood-curdling death screams, but we would like to move. They jump ship. This time he has another screen memory about somebody stalking them. They jump ship again. Finally, the last thing that happens here is it's something that they call in their family the event or the incident of the white thing.
The white thing. That's descriptive.
Yeah. On three separate consecutive nights, starting with Anne, then at Whitley, then with Andrew, each night they're woken up by something poking them.
Was it white?
It was white. It was about 3 feet tall. And as soon as they saw it, it ran away.
What the heck? Yeah.
So it started with Anne, and Anne freaked out. Then it went to Whitley, and Whitley kind of freaked out. He wasn't as freaked out, but he did wake up with a bruise on his arm. And then the last one was Andrew, and Andrew just lost it. And they both had to run in and hold him and say, you know, it's okay, it's okay. They then a few days later go to a wedding, and they call home right before the reception just to see how things are going. And turns out the babysitter called her mother over because as she was making dinner, she looked out the window and she saw a white figure 3 feet high staring at her through the window on the fire escape. And they say,
moving time?
Shoot. Yes. Well, at this point, they try to move, but for whatever reason, they can't.
Okay.
Like, they can't sell the house, so they just buy the cabin instead. And then they start just going to the cabin whenever they get freaked out. So,
because being in an isolated area really screams safety to me.
I know. So that's Whitley's great escape. Now we've got just a little bit left here for you. We're going to keep the rest of his feelings and all of that, a little more of his backstory for next week's episode. But this last thing that he goes through...
This last experience that we're going to touch on tonight.
Mm-hmm. Basically, he goes through hypnosis again. I'm not going to get into details, but he sees six different figures standing around his bed.
Uh-huh.
And they start moving closer and closer and closer. Andrew starts crying. He jumps out of bed. For some reason, he can move this time. He never has been able to move before when he sees them. He jumps out of bed. He runs to Andrew. As soon as he jumps out of bed, they all freak out. They all just jump back and get away from him as if he's some kind of wild animal. He goes and grabs Andrew. Anne is just a moment behind him, and he actually remembers seeing the feminine entity in their living room as he rushed past towards Andrew's room. But he doesn't even stop. He's like, I gotta get to my boy. So Anne's right behind him. They hold him. They calm him down. Suddenly there's an explosion from the kitchen. He runs to the kitchen to see, and they had a bottle of seltzer water that had exploded to the point where the glass was sand. Like, it was not even fractured. It was pulverized. And the seltzer was gone. Like, it, there was no wetness, no liquid anywhere. After the hypnosis, he gets haunted by this image. And it's actually the image that's on the cover of the book. He describes it as not a still life or not a photo, but rather a hologram. And he can say to the hologram, show me your feet, and shows him his feet, their feet. Show me your, you know, your leg, show me your hands, spin around, all of this. And this thing stays with him for days. He gets a sketch artist to come sketch it. One interesting thing is that he, on the 10th, he, or the 13th, yeah, on the 13th, he tapes himself describing it. 10 days later, having not listened to it at all, that tape at all, he describes it again, and they are exactly the same. Which, I mean, that just doesn't happen. With memory, even like a memory of a photograph, you're not going to be able to describe it exactly the same way 10 days later. The really not super great idea that he had is that one day,
oh boy,
he's meditating on the image, and he doesn't necessarily do it, but he thinks of, what happens if I call out to it? What happens if I tell it, it's been following my directions in my head, what happens if I tell it to come to me? And as soon as he has that thought, he says its stare just intensified, and he got super
freaked out. Yeah, that's crazy.
I don't know why he would even go there, why he would even think that. Just a few days later, after he did that, after he said, I wonder what happens, he basically said, all right, well, and he knew, he messed up. He said, okay, if anything's going to happen, I think I am owed confirmation. I think I am owed knowing without a shadow of a doubt that I am not crazy, that this is not a hallucination, that something is happening. Again, why would you do that? Why would you say that?
You're just asking for it, man.
I know. So just a few days later.
Maybe he's just fed up, dude. At this point in time.
Oh, yeah. I bet.
Let's get it over with.
I bet. A few days later, the Strebers had one of Andrew's friends over for a weekend in the country. They were sitting down to dinner, and the little girl, who was his friend, jumped up and started screaming. And she said that a little airplane covered in lights had just flown through the front yard. And Whitley is freaking out on the inside, but externally is very cool and calm and collected. He says, oh, well, it's, you know, the Air Force base is 20 minutes away, 20 miles away. I'm sure it's just that. He goes out and checks, doesn't see anything. When he comes back in, he says, Anne, I may have made a mistake. And she said, because she knew, she didn't necessarily know about the visitors and all of that, but he had told her about the image, which, again, he said it had the urgency of life about it. It was more of a telepathic connection than it was just an image. And she said,
the image of the being, right?
The image of the being. And she said, say what now? And he said, I may have asked it for confirmation. And she said, like, her exact words are something like, I knew you were going to do that. If I could drive, I would take the kids and leave you here to face the music. And then she says, well, okay, I wouldn't do that. And everything's fine for a day or two.
You're getting there, bub.
Everything's fine for a day or two. They actually call the little girl's father. And again, this is the only time he ever mentions UFOs. He just says, do you guys talk about UFOs at home? Do you think about UFOs? Do you have UFO books? And he just says, no, 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 no. He actually asks the girl, he says, have you ever heard of flying saucers? And she says, I don't know what that is, so I'm going to go back to playing now. Is that okay? And he's like, yeah, okay, fine.
Okay, so it's not like some other influence making her think that she saw something weird.
Exactly. So the night of March 16th, 1986. The kids are asleep by 9 o'clock. He and Anne are reading together and decide to go to sleep. He's awakened in the night by a jab to the shoulder. And he is jolted into wakefulness. He saw the shape of three of the shorter dwarf-like, the mechanics, basically.
The tinkers,
by the side of the bed, just staring at him. He tried to turn on the light, and he found that he could move. It just wasn't really easy. So it took him like 45 seconds to reach the light. He finally does and flicks it. Nothing happens. He looks over, and again, that burglar alarm is still there. It is on. So the power is on, but it's just not coming on for the light. He looks back, And he says that what he sees is so bizarre that he has no idea what to make of it. He basically sees a being, the fourth type of being, where it's a lot like the gray,
tall,
but
slender.
Shorter.
Oh, wait.
Tall, short, slender, round eyes. He sees this being.
Teddy bear eyes.
Standing by his bed, dressed in a double-breasted blue suit.
Well, I mean, at least he dressed up for the occasion.
With a white handkerchief staring at him. And all four of them now are just standing there. They look like they're smiling. They kind of look like they're happy. And they're not moving. They're not menacing. They're literally just standing there to be observed. And he says, well, it's only polite that I smile back. So he smiles back and they disappear. And that, as far as we know, as of according to Communion, that's his last encounter with the visitors. He goes right back into sleep. And when reflecting upon it in the book, he says, I didn't ask for proof. I asked for confirmation. And that's what he got. Because he was. It wasn't through hypnosis that he remembered this. It wasn't through shattered dreams and memories. Flesh and blood right there in front of him. He saw it. And that's all he needed. So, really quick, the name Communion comes from the fact that if these encounters, he and Anne talk about it, if these encounters are happening, they're not happening out of fear, out of, like, we want to control you or anything like that. They're happening because they believe that the visitors want to hold communion with the human beings. Of course, his Catholic upbringing is going to play a part in that. Mm-hmm. But essentially that he believes that they are here to gain a deeper understanding of us so that we can gain a deeper understanding of them. And that's what we're going to kind of dive into last week. I know it's insane because it's been like an hour and a half and it feels like it's been 4 hours because it has for us. But this is still just part one. Next week, we're going to get into some of the collaborating evidence, some of the theories.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've given us a lot to think about mm-hmm. over this next week. A lot of possible research that you all might want to dig into yourself.
Yeah.
At least maybe stir the pot and get some conversation going.
Yeah. Look it up. Look around. The only source I have for this episode is the book Communion. We'll put Jason's video that he found of the Dreamland podcast, or maybe if I can just find that podcast episode, put that in the show notes. But that's it for Communion Part 1, my guys, my friends, my dudes.
Our people.
So, last things, okay, we actually got 2 new reviews, which is good because we didn't get a review last week and it made us sad. Yeah,
what,
remember?
Reviews?
Yeah, we got 2 reviews. Oh, I didn't tell you that. I post like every review on the Instagram page, but you never go to the Instagram page
because I don't Instagram.
That's fair. You don't Facebook, you don't Instagram, you don't do anything like that.
It's
fine.
Don't really like people.
I understand. You're just like that wizard on High Brazil. I do not like
Can I have people. Giant bunny rabbits? Yes. Can they be made out of chocolate?
So, the first one is from a fellow named K-Dot. He says, and I can't tell you how much I love this review, especially this first sentence. He says, it takes guys talking about stuff to a meaningful level.
What?
That is like exactly what we're going for here.
Talk at a meaningful level? What?
Yeah. He says, fantastic sound quality, great rapport, the best memes, which I don't know about that one. I guess, do we drop memes in the show a lot?
What?
Maybe.
I don't know what you're talking about.
That's fair. Anyway, the best memes. I'll take it.
It's great because memes are like a visual thing, and we are totally audio. So
that's true.
I mean,
that's true. Sad pupper.
Inside jokes for days.
There
though.
We go.
There we go.
So the other one
that's
is by Daffid Bryn. He just says, fascinating. I learned so much on this pod, and I can't stop listening. So guys, thank you so much for those beautiful iTunes reviews. There's one other.
Oh man, that was on iTunes?
Yeah, that's on the iTunes store.
Oh, dang.
We're up to 11 5-star reviews now, which is dope. That's really great, in my humble opinion. I love it. There's one other I'd like to read. This was just a comment that was left on the Facebook page.
Hey, I think I read that one.
Yeah, there we go. This is by Jennifer Edmondson Sweiter. I'm sorry if I mispronounced that. It might be Sweeter.
Maybe not. Maybe I didn't.
That's all right. It says, I love this podcast so much. I love the way the two hosts work together, not trying to overpower each other. I'm very picky, and if I'm annoyed, I'm out. I just listened to Hi Brazil, and my mind is spinning. How did I not know this? I'm the only one in a family of people who shake their heads at me when I even bring up such a topic. So glad to have found you.
Aw, that's Aww. Awesome, Jennifer. Jennifer, right?
It was Jennifer, yes.
Yeah, awesome. Jennifer, I can overpower him whenever I want.
That's true.
Mentally, physically
emotionally.
I've got him.
Intellectually. And so that's those. And then, like we promised, if you donate $1 or more a month on Patreon, we're going to give you a special shout out. So I'm going to shout out all these people.
Shout it.
I'm going to do it in order. So our very first
top
patron.
Top your lungs.
Very first patron.
Or not top your lungs.
No, I'm not going to do that. Is Keely Mills.
Yeah, Keely.
Woo! Our very second patron is Dominic Tolman.
Yeah, Dominic.
Our very third patron is Nicole Hochstrasser.
Nicole, thank you.
Where are we at? That was three. Oh, our very fourth patron is Kayla Kwanowski.
Yeah, Kayla.
Okay, now we're going to get into some other patrons here. The very fifth is actually my brother, Jacob Fredrickson.
All right, Jacob.
Get out of here, Jake.
Oh, okay.
And
I'm enjoying this part the most.
Thank you. Thank you, Jake. You're not my favorite brother, but you are a good brother.
Wow. How many brothers do you have? I have two brothers. Okay.
And I don't have a favorite brother, just like I don't have a favorite sister.
I have a favorite brother.
Is it Jeremy?
Well, I only have one real brother.
Fair.
Yeah, so.
That's fair. Yeah. I only have one sister.
I don't get to choose.
I only have one sister, but I still don't call her my favorite sister. I'm kidding.
Is your mom on this list?
And next up is Lori Fredrickson, my mom.
All right.
Okay, and then I'm actually going to jump ahead here. Next up is, we've got one special one we're saving for last. Next one is my other brother, Ben Fredrickson.
There you go, Ben.
And it should be noted.
The favorite brother.
That Jake and Ben both have significant others. So Jake and Maddie are one set, and Ben and Camille are another set. So really, thank you, Jake and Maddie. Thank you, Ben and Camille.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
Now, this last one is one that's super, super amazingly special to me. But this last one is someone who I am pretty tempted to call our original fan. She reached out to us on Instagram after the Black Knight Satellite episode, and just every time we post about a new episode or we put anything up about, you know, a promo image or something, she just tells us how much she loves the show and how much she likes it and how she feels. She always talks about how she feels like she's found her people because she didn't have this sort of an outlet before. She says that the show is her family's favorite. So we have our last sponsor and the only person that I do not know in real life, Leilani Bush. You are our number one original fan.
Yay! Thank you, Leilani. And just as a little tidbit there, Sam frequently questions himself whether or not this is something you'd enjoy listening to.
I do. I literally do. I say, is Leilani going to like this?
Yeah. Frequently.
Just every day. Every day. But, guys, thank you.
Absolutely.
You've made it an amazing week for us. We've had a world record. Not world record, but our personal record-breaking week.
It's breaking our world.
You know where to find us. We're on Twitter at Not Alone Pod. Yeah, not at Not Alone Pod. We're on Facebook at Not Alone Pod. We're at Instagram at Not Alone Podcast. Email us, notalonepodcast@gmail.com. Really quick for the special announcement I hinted to earlier. Next week is Communion Part 2. The week after that, we're going to do The Beast of Bray Road, which is the Wolfen, essentially. So
okay,
that's
cool.
Going to be amazing. And guys, thank you so much. We cannot express our gratitude enough. So do a little research in the meantime if you want. We're going to be back a week from when you're listening to this.
Or your own opinions. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll cover the same things that you question and are wondering about as well.
And I did it last week.
Oh, you want me to do it? You're going to trust me?
Yes. Remember to say remember. You always forget to say remember.
Which is ironic.
I know, right?
Yeah. All right, so remember, whether you're locking up your cabin late at night or trying to recollect what just happened the last few hours, we are
not alone.
Woo! Yeah!
We did it!